Mr. Jewett, reel 23.
Oh, yes. So these lads, well, none of us said anything. We just looked at each other because there were two or three of us had recognised this radar system that they had, which was, in actual fact, it was an efficient system, but it wasn't to us. We had better stuff than that on our ships. And in fact, we did. We had better stuff than that on the. We had better stuff than that on the Vigilant, both on the Vigilant and the Ashanti and the Vigilant. But coming back to another job was at Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I went to, and it was most fascinating experience. I went to Grand Rapids, and I was. Met. I don't know if you've ever been on the train. It's quite a long way. Grand Rapids is a long way from Boston, and you buy your ticket in Grand Central Station, and it's a great big long thing. And they tear off as each station you come to. You stop. The train stops, and they tear off, and they take a piece of the ticket collector collects the pieces, the name of the station as you go through. Very efficient system, actually. And it starts off with about half a yard long, but it gets down to to the one you're going to. Well, I went to Grand Rapids, and I thought, oh, it's just going to be a sort of little chat to the schoolgirls of this high school, this Grand Rapids High School, and when I got there, train approaching Grand Rapids, there was a band and all sorts of things, and I thought, well, there must be some VIP on this train, and in it comes, and there was crowds of people, must have been about 400 or 500 people all around there, and I'm looking around to see who the hell this, like, the football player or whoever it was that was going in. And to my absolute astonishment, it was me they were there to meet. I nearly had a fit. So it's this band and everything else. And the mayor and Uncle Tom Cobley and all was there to meet me, and the principals from the school. And I was whipped into a car, and I was taken off, lovely greeting for me, to this high school. What the damn name of it was called? It was in Grand Rapids anyway. It was a school, high school, and I had lunch. And they said, "Well, after lunch, you'll come and give us a talk about things in America and so forth." So I thought it was the usual, you know, about 20 or 30 people, you know, with questions coming in and ducking the column. They always asked about the Queen and your Queen and your King. Your King it was then. Your King. Have you met anybody? And I felt sorely tempted sometimes to say, oh, yes, I'm from close personal friends of mine, actually. I don't know if... I think they'd have swallowed it. But anyway, here I lands at this high school, this beautiful building high school, and I had this lunch. And at about half past one, 2 o'clock, there I had to go out on the stage. And to my astonishment, what I thought wasn't what I thought. There were about 1,500, maybe 2,000 people in this grand reception place of the, it's like a concert hall in this high school. And they introduced me, I said, they had all my particulars and everything, would introduce me, and I hadn't prepared this at all, you know, I had to give it off the cuffs, but I didn't know. I thought it was the usual bit chit chat, you know. That you do, and anyway, I got away with it. So they clapped and everything, and I spent a couple of evenings with some people called Badges. That was the name, Badges. BATTJES. Badges. Nick Badges in Grand Rapids, and there I realised what a lovely people the Americans are when you get to really know them. I stayed with them because they realised I'd come a long way. I couldn't go screaming straight back. Stayed with this family, and when for the evening meal, I got the first surprise was the evening meal, when Mr. Badges, the father of the house, opens the Bible and he read a passage from the Bible before he said grace. And I thought that was rather nice. But they do that for every meal before they go. And they were a Dutch Reformed Church. They were members of the Dutch Reformed Church. And they were very, very, very strict. And they were very lovely people. And I learned, God, before I came back to Boston, it really converted, because everybody thinks the Yanks are, well, I don't know what they're like now, but then I got a very big surprise. They weren't as promiscuous and free and easy as one may think. Nick Badges was the son who'd come back as a soldier, and he was a hell of a nice guy too. So there you are.
We didn't establish the size and the.
She was. The Leander was Leander class, and she was the same as the class of cruiser. She was a 6-inch gun cruiser, and she had six-inch guns mounted in twin turrets, three twin turrets, two forward and one turret aft. And if you remember the Battle of the River Plate, then there was the two cruisers were 6-inch cruisers. The Achilles was one. They're all Greek names, you know, the Achilles and the Exeter Achilles, and I can't remember the other name of the other one. But they were all the Leander was they were Leander class, and this particular one had been torpedoed in the Pacific, but she'd got through it all right and got her back to Boston. And they were completely refitting her, completely, with all the very latest radar and sonar and everything and gunnery systems that they had. So she was really a brand new ship, although she was a tonnage, was about 6,000 tons. And that was her armour. She had small arms and complement, I think, about 600, I think, about 500 or 600.
And the captain, what was he like?
Oh, Otway Ruthven, his name was. He was a four-ring captain, wonderful man. I don't know much about him. I don't know where he came from or anything. I never did find out. But he was a gentleman. He was nobody's fool. He was cool as a cucumber. We went to we had a dance. I went to a most wonderful experience. I was invited through the British Information Service. I was invited to the Wellesley College. Now, Wellesley College was one of the upmarket, like the Clifton of America, where all these presidents' daughters and Chiang Kai-shek's daughter went to Wellesley College. It was called a junior promenade. It was like a dance, and I'd been invited, God only knows why, I don't know, to this junior promenade of Wellesley College, and I was sort of quite a celebrated guest there, actually, and it's I've never been to one before or since. It's a ladies' college, you know, young ladies' college, and their education's much longer than ours. You know, they're all young women, about 18, 17, 18, 19, and this is the promenade, and it's another name for a dance. You know, promenade is a dance, and it's evening dress and all the rest of it, or uniform, and I was in uniform, so I didn't have to worry. But it was very, very nice, actually, that. And the other thing we went to, the social event we had there, was the ship's dance. I've still got the ticket somewhere upstairs. The tickets were printed, beautifully printed, and they all the people that had entertained us, the ship's company and everything, we were invited to bring guests, any but guests we knew, we were invited to take to the ship's company. The Royal Marine Band were doing that, and it was a very, very elaborate affair, the ship's dance, which took place in one of the people. One of the interesting things was the Jewish Welfare Board on Commonwealth Avenue. They entertained us royally. I remember a chap called Dan something or other, and the English in particular, they were very, very fond of us, in spite of the fact that we were giving them, I wasn't there, but the Royal Navy were giving them some stick over the Palestine, you know, over Israel at that time, illegal immigrants, and God knows why, looking back on history, I think we must be run by a madman at times, because they were so nice to us. Because we, you've got to remember, while we were there, they dropped the bomb, the nuclear weapon, and we were okay up to that. The moment that the nuclear weapon dropped, martial aid stopped the very following day, not one day after. And I can tell you that now. Our allowances and everything just dropped. Well, what happened then was most of us, we just had our pay, naval pay, even as POs, even as officers, wouldn't keep us in toothpaste. And the gunnery officer, a fellow called Lieutenant Parker, hell of a nice chap, and I became the commanding officer. I got a job as PO, the commanding officer's PO. I worked in an office. And Parker, who was there, he was sort of showing us the way. The officers had to do a lot of entertaining. And I lent him £100 because he was in such a state. It was in dollars, it was equivalent of 100. And I was a PO, but I mean, that's between you. I mean, I've never seen anything from that day to this. But they were so, the officers were, so I got a job ashore, working in the Miles Standish Hotel, and it was a 4-star hotel, a big place. And I got in there, and I was washing up dishes to make money. Might have made a lot of money, I'll tell you that now.
In your spare time?
In the evening, when we finished ashore, we went ashore and.
Did a number of people do this?
Everybody. Not a number, officers as well. They did it too, because we just could not make it. The rate of exchange was so ridiculous. I mean, I was earning on equivalent of, I suppose, looking back on it, about 10 shillings a week, which was peanuts, you know, and in those days. And so was the officers weren't much better off, because believe it or not, there isn't that big a differential between officers and ratings, I can tell you, especially when you get to some of the ratings that I became a petty officer gunnery instructor. If you look at the rate scale, there's not that much. When you take out their mess bills and things, what they've got to take, they're out of. They were in a terrible mess. Some of these officers left America hundreds of pounds in debt, and that is a fact. But whether that was their problem, they got out of it. On the other hand, people like me and lower deckers and the able seamen who went ashore. One chap went ashore and he established a lorry. He was a truck driver. He established a lorry. He owned 3 lorries before he came back, in a period of about 8 or 9 months, you know, because we came back in the November. And he owns these 3 lorries. And there was all sorts of opportunities. Well, I came back with enough money paid into the post office. We used to pay our money into the post office, you see. They paid us every. I got a job washing up dishes at first. After that, Mr. Bulletti was so interested in. He was the manager, was so interested, and he appointed me as night reception. I came on at 6 o'clock at night on the reception desk, and I had to put a tuxedo on, you know, one of these white tuxedos. And I came quite good at it, and I made lot. And I got a lot of tips. You know, when Mr. Brown, 60, with his wife, Mrs. Brown, about 22, came on, and Mr. Smith. Times don't change.
long were you there?
I can't remember. Some months, anyway, in a period of about 4 or 5. Overhaul. Well, we left in August. Leander left Boston around about the August to September, and I went out there in January, so it gives you that span. You can work it out from that span. But I didn't get anything from the British Information Service. I got nothing. That was voluntary work, you know, voluntary. But this, when I worked at the Miles Standish, I got paid for that. And did I not? I came back from America just working in the evening with enough money to buy a nice semi-detached house. That's the difference. That's what I tell you. Well, converting those dollars back into European, that's the difference it made. Like swallowing your pipe and polishing a few brasses on the outside of the hotel and washing up and doing. They made a great fuss of me, actually. They had. I learned about the hotel trade. They had these black cap chefs and five star chefs, and they could make anything. They were marvellous, and they used to take a delight in making me a special disc before I went home at 11:30 or 12 o'clock, before I went back to the ship. You know,
How did you celebrate VE and VJ while you were there?
Oh, I got gloriously drunk. I'd been to a show called Memphis Bound. It was a show, and there was some people there. There was the leader, one of the leading actresses was Thelma Carpenter, and she got involved later on with the cousin of the Queen, actually. I forgot his name, Marquess of Milford Haven, I think it was. Yeah, that's right. After the war. I don't know if she was looking for me or what, I don't know. But I had, there was Thelma Carpenter, Will Gear, another actor who was over it, and another one. And I ended up at the Parker House with Will Gear, Thelma Carpenter, and a chap called Johnson, Bojangles. He was a tap dancer in this show called Memphis Bound. And I got gloriously drunk, to tell you the truth. I remember it to this day. When they dropped the atom bomb, and VJ was out, I got absolutely glorious drunk on this wonderful drink that they'd never heard of in this country called Southern Comfort. It was a lovely drink, and you can buy it anywhere now. But in those days, it'd never been heard of here. But it was great, great drink.
Was there a moment of nostalgia from friends who had gone down and were no longer with you at that time?
No, but what there was a moment of, it was a realisation that something was taken away from my psyche. You've got to remember that since being a boy, I've been trained and attuned to wartime. Bombs on London, every news was about the war, everything I did was about the war and fighting the war. But as soon as the peace was declared, because I wasn't in this country for VE Day, I wasn't in this country, I know nothing about that. I know they enjoyed themselves and all the rest of it, but I was in America. And all of a sudden I realised, from that point onwards, because we've got to remember that Leander was going to the Far East, she was destined for the invasion of Japan. That was what was in our mind. We were focused. Nobody minded. That was the job. But I suddenly realised that something had taken place. I felt naked. I had no sense of purpose. I was a key in the war and the war effort, and that was it. And that was gone. That was the difference it made to me. It was I was stripped. I was stripped of my purpose, if you know what I mean. It was rather a strange thing to happen, but it did. I had to now attune myself to peacetime, which seemed to me to be a bigger rat race than it was in wartime. In wartime, everything was worked out. I thought, well, you know, I'm going to get my GI's rank. I'm going to go for a career. I'm going to be an officer. And everything was worked out. I had it all worked out in my mind, and it all went. All went pear-shaped, I think. went wrong, you know.
Was there an adjustment in ranks when peacetime came?
No, none at all, none at all.
You were substantive, in effect. Oh, you kept your rank.
That's right, I kept my rank, yes. Although it was called a temporary rank, it was in fact substantive. They couldn't.
So you sailed at the back end of the year, and you came back to where?
Came back to South Shields. And when we got to South Shields, got into South Shields dock, and all came back. And in the meantime, I had applied for a gunnery instructor's course, the GI, what they call a GI, which is the highest gunnery rank in the lower deck. It's the highest, I would become then the highest rank there is in the lower deck. I was the real McCoy, you know, sort of the equivalent of a sergeant major in the army. And it was granted. And I then went to Chatham Barracks, where I became a GIQ, which meant that I wore white gaiters and a white belt, and I was in a class that we started off with seven or eight of us. I think it was eight of us started off. To cut a long story short, I'm quite proud of this. There was only three of us finished the course, and I came top. I was quite and I was probably the youngest gunnery instructor, one of the youngest, at least one of the youngest gunnery instructors ever to qualify in Chatham Barracks. So I was quite pleased about this.
Had there been any changes in gunnery by the end of the war?
Not a great deal.
Improvement no.
The radar had come on the scene, which improved the ranging, that's all. Whereas it was optical range finding before during the war. But even then they had it as a backup, because radars run by electricity, and if the electrical circuit gets blown out, you've got to get a range from somewhere, and that used to happen. I mean, I saw the sinking of the Hood the other day. What a disaster! And that could happen to any ship, of course, you know, or get a direct hit, you know, from a big shell.
So, what does this entail, being an instructor?
It's a long course, actually. They spend at that time round about £4,000 or £5,000 on training you. It meant that you're the absolute authority on all forms of gunnery on a ship. There's only one on each destroyer, maybe two on a cruiser, and maybe three or four at the very most on a battleship, which of course by now were finished. I mean, the Vanguard was the only one left. But you're the absolute sole. You're the best. Now you've got to learn gunnery mathematics and theory. You've got to learn radar. You've got to learn about radar. You've got to learn about fire control, ammunition, how to appraise ammunition. Because ammunition goes. You've got to have lot numbers on each of the cordites, because it goes wrong. You see, otherwise it's got to be retraced. Everything that happens to encourage. Not only that, you've got to know all your drills. You've got to learn to drill squads. I had when I passed out on my parade training, I had to bury an admiral. Theoretically, I had to teach. They gave me a squad in Chatham Barracks. They gave me a squad of completely untrained sailors, and they said, "You have got to train these. You've got to bury an admiral in 4 days' time." He says, "You've got to train these in the next 4 hours to bury an admiral." And they gave me 4 hours in which to train them. I had to describe a rifle, how to slope arms, all the elementary things, how to form lane, form present, rest on your arms, reserve. It entailed every movement there is with a rifle on parade training. That I had to do. I had to take the parades, various parades, which we all had to do, you know, as current GIQs. And you're quite exhausted. You're in your class. I think my class, can't remember my class, number 94, I think it was something like that. And my class, and I've got my gunnery history sheet, and it's there for all to see. And there are 24 subjects. I mean, there's inclinometer, range finder, ordnance, you know, the gun itself. There's gun drills. Now I had to know 4-inch gun, 6-inch gun, and 15-inch gun. I mean, the captain of a 15-inch turret is a GI, and he's the monarch of all arts of play. You know, there's two twin. Well, the governor there is a GI. He stands on the center, in the center of the two. And there's two captains of each gun, but he's the captain of the turret. And as I say, it's quite a job. And I was very proud that I passed this examination.
And what did happen then? Did you go back to sea, or was it a land job?
No, I didn't. I became, once I was promoted and rated, I became the gunnery. I was the GI of the what they call the heavy gun battery. The heavy gun battery is 6-inch guns and 4-inch guns. And my next task was to train the Chinese Nationalist Navy. And I trained all the Chinese sailors for the... there were 2 6-inch cruisers which they had acquired from us for what was then the Chinese Nationalist Navy fighting against the Chinese. And I trained the guns crew. They were very nice guys too. But all their guns were, all their gunnery, all their 4-inch guns drill, all the drill to fire the guns, because there's about 8 or 9 in each set of guns, is in English. It was poor souls, they had an awful job getting their hands, get their tongues around. The trouble was that when, with an English crew, if I gave them a bollocking, they knew exactly where they stood. But I was bollocking these Chinese chaps, and they just looked at me, and I was wasting my time. I thought they couldn't understand a word I was saying, which wasn't very nice, I can tell you. I wasn't calling them very nice names. And because you're allowed to, it's one of those sort of things, perks. You've got to drill those, lick those into shape. But I had a wonderful interpreter called Petty Officer Chan. He was a PO, and he was a Chan. He was in their navy, and he interpreted very, very well indeed what I was saying. And while I was doing this, I trained 3 or 4 guns crews, and Chan was with me all the time, acting as my interpreter. I did them in fire control and all sorts of things. Because they always used to amuse me when it would say, down 1,000, ziggy-zaggy, shoot. They used to say ziggy-zaggy. They couldn't say zigzag. They used to say ziggy-zaggy. It used to amuse me immensely. But an AFO, an Admiral Fleet order, came out that peacetime petty officers could purchase their discharge. Now, you've got to remember, I'd had 6 years of war. I'd been lumbered with the Chinese National Navy, and it was driving me up the wall, actually. It was really, really hard going. It wasn't like talking to English, people who spoke English. Everything they did was in English, but they had to learn it. And for example, there's a part of the gun called an interceptor. And no way could these Chinese lads say interceptor. There's no way. They used to stand there looking at me solid. And I said, right gun, interceptor, closed, interceptor. And you'd see them struggling to get this word interceptor out. They just couldn't say it. And although that they used to have to sort of say this part of the gun drill, which they had to do. So I was going pretty bonkers. So this came out, and I went down, and I thought, well, I don't know. All around me, all my colleagues were leaving, all the HOs were leaving the Navy, everybody was leaving the Navy, going out, and I thought, God, well, if I stayed in the Navy, I wouldn't get very far, because I'm only from a working class family, and the Navy was very, very snobbish and class conscious. You know, my daddy had been in rife, but if I'd been to a public school, or been to a good grammar school, or if my daddy had been hunting, shooting, fishing, I might have stood a bit of a chance. But I came from a large family, I had no chance at all. If I'd got my commission, well, I think I might have got my commission all right, no problem. I would have got maybe as far as 2.5 ringgit if I was lucky. So I thought, well, let's have a go at Civvy Street.